Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hey, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. I'm so excited about this episode of The Faith Explained as we continue with our series, Exodus, the Power and Presence of God. We're going to meet the main man, the man of the hour, the main character in this entire narrative of the book of Exodus, Moses, the lawgiver, the judge, the guy that God uses to redeem his people, Israel. So we're going to meet him. But before we do that, let's just back up a little bit, just to the very last verse of chapter 1, which we were looking at last time. And that kind of leads into chapter 2 of Exodus, where it talks about the birth and infancy of Moses. And there's just some beautiful stuff here, which I think you're really going to love. So open up your Bible to Exodus chapter 1. Verse 22, and we'll read straight through to Exodus chapter 2, verse 10, the end of that verse. All right, here's what it says. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took to wife a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds at the river's brink. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. And he became her son, and she named him Moses, for she said, "Because I drew him out of the water." Okay, let's stop here and talk about it a little bit. Now, this is the most important event at the beginning of Exodus. Now, the stage has been set, obviously, with the Hebrews, the Israelites, in slavery, in bondage under Pharaoh, forced to build these store cities. And then, of course, the genocide happens, from slavery to genocide, as Pharaoh decides to kill all the male children to be born, because he's so fearful of them. They're multiplying. As the text says, they're literally swarming like flies. He's afraid of a revolt, a rebellion, afraid of losing his power. So that's all the setup for what happens now at the beginning of chapter 2, Moses' birth. So this is incredible. As Thomas Dozeman says, so far, the perspective that's been given to us has been kind of a panoramic perspective. It's the wide-angle lens. It's the bird's eye view, as it were, talking about the Israelites as a whole, as a group. And now we're going to get sort of the worm's eye view. We go from a bird's eye view to a worm's eye view. We're going to narrow the lens. We're going to really hone in and zone in on this one Israelite family. Now, the theme of fertility, that's there once again. As a people, they are multiplying. They're all over the place. And now we have this one family, which is also fertile. A child is born. And so we have the birth of Moses. And then this whole section we're going to see later on, it ends with the birth of Moses. Later on, he's going to have his own son at the end of chapter 2. But we'll get there when we get there. Now, What's interesting too is, as we mentioned before, Pharaoh is so afraid of the Israelites as they're multiplying and there's just more and more of them. Little does he know that one of them is going to be adopted into his own family. Their fertility is going to reach right into his own home without his knowledge. What a delicious irony. You have to love how God orchestrates these events. And there's also this big theme, as Josemann talks about, the contrast between death and life. Now, way back at the beginning of chapter 1 of Exodus, talked about, of course, the death of Joseph and all the patriarchs, but then the life, the new life, the teeming life of the Israelites. We're going to see this again, even in Moses' own career at the beginning. He's going to kill an Egyptian. We'll see that later. And then he's going to provide life for others. He's going to rescue the daughters of Reuel. And he's going to find a wife there. He's going to have the birth of his own son. So from death to new life. We're going to see this time and time again. So I really like the beginning of this little section in chapter 2 when Moses' parents, they know that there's this edict by the king that all the male children should be murdered, thrown into the Nile. And despite this, they have faith. They decide to go ahead and build their family, to have their son. And this is a really good example for us too, because the fact of the matter is the circumstances are never favorable. They're never quite what we'd like them to be, but we must forge ahead with God's plans for us. A lot of people today say, how could I bring a child into this world with all its problems, with all the dangers, with all the evil in the world, with all the problems in my own life? It takes a lot of hope. It takes a lot of faith, but God has a plan. And so we must forge ahead, trusting in him. And that's exactly what these parents did. So it talks about how a man from the house of Levi, one of the Levites, marries a daughter from that same tribe, a daughter of Levi. Now, it's not their first child, as we'll see. Moses has an older sister. Now, she's not named in this chapter, but as we'll find out later, her name is Miriam, and she becomes very key in this whole story of salvation. Now, there are a number of allusions here in this account of Moses, how he's born, how he is redeemed from the Nile. This is incredible stuff, and Josemann points a lot of these out. Other commentators have too. When Moses is born, what happens in verse 2? The mother sees that he is good. He is good. What does that remind you of? Reminds us of the first part of the book of Genesis. And I've been telling you that Genesis and Exodus are linked very much. Now, of course, they're both part of the Pentateuch, the five books traditionally attributed to Moses. Genesis and then Exodus, but these two books are linked they're weaved very closely together. So when you read Genesis 1, you see a lot of allusions to what's going on with Moses here. If you look at the beginning, and that's what Genesis means, in the beginning, seven different times it says God saw that it was good. All these aspects of creation, God saw that it was good. And that's exactly what happens here with Moses, that he is good. That's what his mother sees when he is born. And he is good. Every human person is good, created in the image of Almighty God. And so that's what we have here in the birth of Moses. We also see this. What else happened in Genesis? God commands our first parents to what? Be fruitful and multiply. Well, that's what the Israelites are doing in Egypt. They're certainly becoming fruitful. They're swarming and Pharaoh's freaking out. But we have here this one couple in particular. Let's narrow the focus here. They also are trying to obey that command, being fruitful, multiplying. Of course, there's Miriam, and now there is Moses in this family. So the mother, of course, is terrified. She's worried for Moses' safety. And he hasn't been given the name Moses yet. We'll explain what that means in just a second. But she can't hide him forever. He's getting bigger. And so eventually this plan is concocted. She puts him in a basket in the reeds of the Nile River. Now, this is really important to know as well. The word that's used for basket in the text of Exodus chapter 2, in the Hebrew text, it's the same word that is used for the ark of Noah in the book of Genesis. Because whenever you see water, the water can mean a few different things. Water can mean death and chaos, judgment, destruction. Think about the floodwaters of Genesis that deluged the ancient world and punished it for all its sinfulness. But water can also mean salvation. Think about the waters of baptism, for example. And we see, of course, the waters of the Red Sea. The Israelites are going to pass through them to salvation and safety. And so all of this is kind of in the background here. The basket, it's the same word as the ark in Genesis chapter 6, verse 14, when God says to Noah, make for yourself an ark. Now, what about these reeds along the edge of the Nile River? That's not a throwaway description by any stretch of the imagination. Now, in this case, we're not looking backwards to the waters of creation, the waters of the flood, the destruction, but it's actually looking forward to something that's going to happen in the future. Of course, later on in Genesis chapter 14, we're going to see how God saves his people at the Sea of Reeds, or the Red Sea. The Red Sea is also called the Reed Sea. That might actually be its official name. And so, the reeds along the Nile in Egypt, obviously, as someone reading the book of Exodus, you know the story. You're going to think forward to what's going to happen, God's salvation at the Reed Sea. So we see here that what happens in the life of Moses is going to happen in the lives of all of the Israelites in the future. And Dozman does a really good job of pointing this out. What happens as he's put through this ordeal? Is he going to survive his time in the Nile River, the reeds, the Nile River? Well, obviously what he goes through and how he's kind of saved through this is a prefigurement of how all Israelites are going to be saved at the Reed Sea. Now, later on, we're going to see how Moses alone meets God on the mountain. He meets Yahweh in chapter 3, the burning bush. Well, later on, all the Israelites are going to meet God on that same mountain in chapter 19. And we'll get to this when we get to this. This is another part of Exodus that's kind of a real head-scratcher. God actually tries to attack Moses. He sets out to kind of destroy him. Well, what? Hang on here. If he's dead, how is he going to get the people out of Egypt? Well, as we'll see in chapter 4, God wants to attack Moses. What does this mean? Well, God's going to eventually attack the Egyptians as well, especially the firstborn, the night of the Passover, and we'll see that in Exodus chapter 12. So we see Moses kind of prefiguring in his own life what's going to happen to all the people. Again, this is really typology at its finest, how God writes history the way human beings write with words. As human authors use foreshadowing, these literary devices, God uses actual people, places, things to foreshadow greater things he's going to do in the future. So Moses is kind of a stand-in, in a certain sense, for all Israel. And eventually, Moses is a prefigurement of a much greater leader and prophet who is to come, Jesus Christ, God incarnate. And Matthew presents Jesus as a new and greater Moses. As Moses comes down the mountain with 10 commandments, Jesus comes down with 10 beatitudes. And the five books of Moses, there are five books, if you will, within the Gospel of Matthew. So the parallels are pretty obvious if you're looking for them. So let's get back now to what's happening at the Nile River in Exodus chapter 2. You're listening to our new series, Exodus, the Power and Presence of God, on Relevant Radio, the Faith Explained program. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Now let's go back to verse 4 through 10 of chapter 2. Pharaoh's daughter, she's bathing in the river. She's got her handmaidens with her. You know, they're kind of her helping her out and being security, whatever the case may be. And she's bathing in the river. And then she sees this ark, you know, the basket floating towards her. And maybe hears a baby crying. What is going on here? So she says, okay, go get this basket. Let's open it up. And so she does. And then she sees this crying baby. She knows that it's one of the Hebrew children. And it tells us in verse 6 that she has compassion on this infant, and she wants to save his life. So just as before, we met these midwives who disobeyed Pharaoh. This is civil disobedience, as Dozman says. They refused to partake in his evil plot to murder the Hebrew boys. They even lie to him. They throw him off track. And they're not going to go along with this sin. And neither does Pharaoh's daughter. She also, in a sense, rejects and repudiates the evil of her father and participates in this kind of civil disobedience, if you will. So she brings him up out of the water. And then we get the name Moses. Now, what does his name really mean? There's basically two answers to this question. Is it an Egyptian name? And what does that mean? Or is it really a Hebrew name? Well, a lot of people think it's actually an Egyptian name. And so how does this kind of work? Well, the Egyptian word Moses is kind of an interplay here. The Egyptian, it comes from a verb that means to be born. And there's another noun in there that means a son. So it's kind of a son is born in a certain sense. There are a lot of Egyptian pharaohs. Here's one of them. Thutmose was the name of one of the pharaohs. Well, that comes from the word Thut, and Thut is the Egyptian moon god. So Thutmose means the son of the moon god, the son of Thut. So, okay, when we come to the name Moses then, it could mean adoption. He is the son of, right? The one who is born, the son of. So she adopts him. He became her son. That's essentially what's going on here. And that's why his name is Moses or Moshe in Hebrew. So that might be where the name comes from. But there's also sort of a Hebrew explanation for this as well. Because in the text it says, Pharaoh's daughter says, I drew him out of the water. I drew him out of the water. So this actually comes from the Hebrew verb to draw out. That's where the name Moses comes from. A drawer from water. It's kind of interesting because that's exactly what happened to him. He was pulled out of the Nile River. But also, it might point forward to how God's going to use Moses to save people through water. He draws people from the water. So later on, as we're going to see, he's going to meet his wife. He's going to save the daughters of Reuel at the well in Midian, the well of water. And of course, later on, he's going to lead Israel through the Reed Sea, through the waters. And so, hard to say whether originally the name was Egyptian or Hebrew, but might never know the answer. And now we see the role also of Miriam, the sister of Moses. Now she's not named here. We don't know her name is Miriam. Later on in the book, we are told. And so Moses is not the first child in his family. She's from the tribe of Levi too, of course, Miriam. And she helps a great deal. She's there. She's kind of at the rescue. She's watching what's going on with the basket. And she, as Dozman says, enters into a negotiation with Pharaoh's daughter. And Pharaoh's daughter doesn't even know she's in a negotiation. She just kind of shows up, you know, almost by accident and says, hey, wow, that's the great baby you've got there. Hey, I've got an idea. Why don't I get one of the Hebrew women to nurse him? He's obviously a Hebrew baby. And Pharaoh's daughter's like, yeah, that's a great idea. Go do it. And of course, Miriam gets her mom, who's also Moses' mom, and she becomes his nurse. And you got to love this because, again, more irony here. Pharaoh says to Moses' mother, doesn't know it's Moses' actual mother, hey, I will pay you to nurse this child. You're going to get your wages. So, hey, not only is Moses nursed by his own mother in Pharaoh's house, but she gets paid to do it. And it's also an absolute rejection of what's going on with Pharaoh because he's enslaved the Hebrews. They're backbreaking labor. They're not getting paid for their work. It's unjust. It's unfair. Well, the very opposite is happening in Moses' house. She's getting her wages, and she's getting paid to do something she would have done anyways, of course, nurse her own child, who ought to have been killed, but he wasn't. So this is quite critical of the slavery and the evil of Pharaoh. So we've got to leave it here for now, but it's so exciting, this book of Exodus. And after this, we'll find out what happens when Moses, the prince of Egypt, grows up. And he commits a pretty dastardly deed that changes the course of his life. You've been listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. And this is our new series, Exodus, The Power and Presence of God. But don't go away. We've got much more to come right now on The Faith Explained. Okay, now it's time to dip into The Faith Explained mailbag. Now, if you have a question for me, you can write it in at faith@relevantradio.com. That's the email address, faith@relevantradio.com. Or you could find me on Twitter and send your message that way. At Cale Clark is my handle, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. So, okay, let's now look at this question that comes to me from Tammy in Northport, Florida, who is listening on the Relevant Radio app. And she says, "Hi, Cale, isn't it true that the New Testament is shot through with pagan ideas, specifically mythology? And that's really what explains all the so-called miracles in the book." Okay, that's a very, very good question. That's a very good question. This comes up a lot. And Tammy, I want to thank you for writing in, but I do want to disabuse you of this notion that the New Testament is shot through with mythology. That when you see the miracles, things like the virginal conception of Jesus, his control over nature, even the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, his bodily resurrection, a lot of people think this is nothing more than pagan mythology. That is not true. But before we get into that, I want to tell you where this idea really comes from. Well, it kind of got started in modern times by this guy named, he was a German scholar, a New Testament scholar, theologian named Rudolf Bultmann. And he lived in the 19th century in Germany, and he was hugely influential in New Testament studies. And he just insisted that the New Testament was full of mythology. And he said it must be, quote unquote, demythologized. He said that you really have to, almost like a corn or something like this, you need to get rid of the husk. He called it the husk of mythology, so you could get at the quote unquote kernel of truth. So he sort of thought that since the New Testament was written in quote unquote pre-scientific times, that the writers of the New Testament documents held to this sort of three-tiered view of the universe, where there was hell down below, we live in the world, quote unquote, on earth in the middle. Then up above is the realm of God, heaven, where the angels and saints are. Okay. So Bultmann basically said, and his followers said, this is clearly not dealing with reality. These interventions from otherworldly places, heaven, how can we possibly explain this? It's a supernaturalistic worldview. It's mythological. And no serious modern person could possibly believe this. So he said, really, the man Jesus is being lost with all this mythology that's been added onto him, and we got to strip that away to find out what quote unquote really happened. That's essentially the backstory here. But here's the problem: Bultmann and his followers were, number one, they were ruling out the supernatural a priori. He just basically said these things don't happen. Supernatural miracles cannot happen in the world. Now, that itself is a faith position. That's a faith position. That's not based on evidence. So he's a person of faith too. Now, is his faith well placed? I don't think so. This isn't the time to get into this right now, but I have talked about this ad nauseum on this program, also on the Cale Clark Show, the historical evidence for things like the miracles of Jesus, specifically for the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. So here's how we can respond to this, though, in the general. I would say this. Number one, when you look at what, aside from evidence for the resurrection, things like that, look at what the New Testament writers themselves say. For example, in 2 Peter, a document that's attributed to the Apostle Peter, he says, "We were not preaching cleverly invented myths. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty," speaking about Jesus Christ. That's in 2 Peter 1:16. And he's talking about the transfiguration in that particular moment. But that could go for anything else that's miraculous in Jesus' career. The Apostle John, at the beginning of his gospel, at the beginning of one of his letters, he says, we have touched, we have seen the word of life. We experience the incarnate Christ. Here's somebody who would really know about these things, by the way, C.S. Lewis, who, of course, was a great convert to Christianity, the brilliant Oxford scholar. Before he converted, don't forget what he did for a living. He was a doctor of literature. He looked at historical literature, specifically mythological stuff. He even wrote mythological stories himself. And one of the things that Lewis said was that sometimes critics of his work, they just think that he has certain positions, but they've never actually talked to him about it. And it's easy to say, well, the New Testament writers were just teaching a bunch of mythology. But unfortunately, they've passed on now. We can't check with them. But there's very good reason to believe that they were not writing mythology. First of all the New Testament documents were probably written within one generation of the death of Jesus. I think they were all written pre-70 AD, the destruction of the temple. But some people think some of them were written afterwards. It doesn't really matter. Scholars tell us that it takes at least two generations before a myth can develop about somebody, a historical person. We don't have that. There wasn't enough time for a myth to get going about the life of Christ. Don't forget, there were living eyewitnesses to the life, the career, the miracles of Jesus. There were still plenty of them walking around in Galilee when the Gospels were being produced, when the Gospel was being spread. They easily could have refuted the stuff if it wasn't true. Think about the living eyewitnesses of the resurrected Jesus that St. Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 15. He mentions all kinds of people, 500 people, most of whom are still living, who encountered the resurrected Christ. Don't forget also, these documents were written by Jews who were absolutely antithetical to a pagan worldview. They were not into pagan mythology, and most of these mythological ideas came from paganism. They wouldn't have had anything to do with this stuff, and it certainly wouldn't have convinced their fellow Jews that Jesus was the Messiah if they were preaching paganism. So the Jews, or by the way, the Greeks did not believe in resurrection like the Jews did. That's why St. Paul goes to Athens in Acts chapter 17, people scoff at him when he starts teaching about the resurrection. There was one of their famous writers who said, once a person has died, the earth has drank of his blood, there is no resurrection. That's why they laughed at him. So these do not betray any kind of paganism here. And any stories that borrow from Christianity or seem like they're saying the same thing about Christianity, God's becoming human, virgin births, a lot of this stuff came after the New Testament was written. In other words, a lot of pagan myths were borrowing from the Bible, not the other way around. I wish we had more time to get into it, but hopefully that'll suffice to answer your question, Tammy. Thanks for writing in. That's all the time we have for The Faith Explained today, but we'll be back with the next episode on Relevant Radio. Check the podcast if you missed anything. God bless you. I'm Cale Clark. Take care.